I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush has tapped two former presidents to lead a nationwide effort to raise money for the victims of the Asian tsunami. Bill Clinton and the first President Bush will work to secure donations from private citizens and industry. Altogether, 40 countries have promised about $2 billion in aid. But the problem on the ground is making sure those good intentions make it to the people who need them the most. Mike Huggins of the World Food Program says after some initial problems with coordination, aid agencies and governments are starting to work more effectively.
There is a coordinated effort. It may look chaotic, but it is happening, and we are reaching the people.
Tom McCauley is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Indonesia. He joins us now from Medan in the ravaged North Sumatra province. Tom, Secretary of State Colin Powell said in Thailand today there's no further immediate need of U.S. financial aid, and he, Powell, believes the relief efforts are going exceptionally well. How do those relief efforts look to you?
Look, it's a matter of perception. I'm on the ground, and that will certainly look very different from the White House or indeed a plane flying around the affected victims. There have been a lot of complaints on the ground. There have been sporadic comments from some of the foreign governments that they're not receiving clear directions from the central coordinating body, which is the Indonesian government. But as I said, this is a matter of expectations. And a lot of humanitarian disaster relief veterans say that some inertia is normal in the early stages of such operations, particularly given the magnitude of this one and the fact that it's probably the largest humanitarian relief operation ever seen.
Right. One of your colleagues, Faye Bowers, writes today that, in fact, 20 years ago, it would have taken a minimum of 3 weeks to even get to the Aceh region of Indonesia. And now, obviously, people like you have been there. So there's a sense that, you know, there's some miraculous aid as well.
Again, it depends on what your expectations are. If you're a volunteer that's donated your own personal resources and come up here at your own expense and have expertise and skill that can save lives, you're going to be very frustrated at being told to wait at an airport whilst food and logistics supplies pile up high. On the other hand, if you're a government or if you're a development planner who's seen many of these disasters and who are used to a much longer lead time, you're going to be surprised and perhaps even stunned at the speed of the relief. One thing is clear, and that is I think international awareness and concern for countries like Indonesia has increased. Awareness has certainly increased in the United States in the last 20 years. But unfortunately, of course, in recent years, Indonesia has been associated with a number of disasters, perhaps beginning with the financial crisis in 1997.
You told us last week that there was a truce between the separatist region of Aceh and the Indonesian government because of this enormous tragedy. Is that truce holding?
It appears to be. There have been some scattered reports that comments from either side that either side has violated the truce sporadically here and there, but certainly not on a systematic level. I was privy to private conversations between Indonesian military officials in the field and soldiers operating, Indonesian military commanders in the field and soldiers in the field, whereby they're instructed to focus on humanitarian efforts. Now, the GUM, the rebel group, have also likewise said that they're ordering a ceasefire and they're sticking through that. Need to bear in mind that both organizations often see officers in the field deviating from instructions given in the center. So there may be some sporadic deviations and violations, but it's certainly nothing systematic. And people who've been here for a long time have been amazed at how quickly the Indonesian government has reversed its policy of xenophobia and perhaps restricted access. The question really is for how long.
Right.
I personally think it's unlikely that Aceh will stay open in the long term because the Indonesian military, which retains a lot of political influence, considers there to be a serious security threat of separatism. And fear of separatism is something which haunts most leaders of this country, which we have to remember stretches across 17,000 islands.
And as we know, the Indonesian military has been brutal in repressing that separatist movement in the past. You also explain that these islands and much of the Aceh region are barricaded by mountain ranges, bridges, roads and harbors are destroyed by the earthquake. So what is the American military doing to help with relief efforts in the area?
They're supplying Black Hawk helicopters. They're a destroyer and an aircraft carrier. The USS Abraham Lincoln is anchored off the coast of Banda Aceh. And these helicopters and that their marine capacity allows them to reach some of the shattered western coast. The Marines have been distributing food aid sporadically. But again, one of the challenges will be filtering the information about who needs what to the relief authorities, and that's something which has to come from the Indonesian government, which is still in the early stages of mobilization.
We also know that the Exxon company has huge holdings in the Aceh region. Do you have any sense of that corporation doing anything to help out in the region?
They've certainly been called on to contribute to community development under national laws, and certainly have in the past contributed equipment to military operations.
You told us some heartbreaking stories last week, Tom. I'm thinking of one, a father who had to let go of his son when he saw bubbles rise up in the water and realized that he was lost. Have you heard hopeful stories?
There's been a national adoption program being set up by the government. I've heard a rumor that the president's wife will be adopting a couple of Achenese kids. I've also heard that, for example, a bureau administrator of one of the news agencies here is adopting an Achenese child. This is hugely encouraging. I mean, this is a sign of happiness and so much despair and destruction.
Tom McCauley, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Medan in the North Sumatra province of Indonesia. Tom, thank you.
Thanks again.
Well, governments and relief agencies have been put to the test by the sheer breadth of the tsunami disaster. But perhaps no organization faces quite the challenge of the United Nations. And it comes at a time when that world body faces a host of other challenges, from the upcoming elections in Iraq to internal scandals and, perhaps most damaging of all, accusations of irrelevance by one of its founding members, the United States. The New York Times is reporting today that a secret meeting was held recently to shore up the UN and the reputation of Secretary General Kofi Annan. The meeting was held at the home of Richard Holbrooke, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And Ambassador Holbrooke joins us now on the line from New York. Welcome and thank you very much, Ambassador.
It's good to be with you.
Well, let's put aside the Times report. I want you to characterize for yourself what this meeting was about. What was its intent?
Well, first of all, it was part of a whole series of meetings that have taken place in recent weeks, particularly since the American elections, to assess how the UN moves forward. Kofi Annan has got 2 years left as Secretary General. He has had a very difficult year after a terrific early period in which he won the Nobel Prize. And now he reached out to a lot of people. I know that in addition to the group that met at my house, he's also talked to his own staff at great length, which wasn't mentioned in the Times. He's talked to people like President Clinton, his other senior advisors, prominent senators. And the number one thing is that the United Nations cannot succeed unless it has a good relationship with and the full backing of the United States. And the Bush administration came out of the November elections feeling that certain members of the UN were adversarial to George W. Bush. And our view, and I wasn't the stalking horse for the Bush administration, I did not support President Bush for re-election, but I said to the UN people, look, we only have one president at a time. The American people have reelected George W. Bush, and the United Nations cannot be adversarial to him. That was the first of the two key messages of the meeting. And
what was the second?
The second one, which the Times discussed and other people spoke to, was the need to revitalize the bureaucracy, to hold people accountable when they don't perform well, to clean up the whiff of scandal around the all-for-food thing by cooperating fully with Volcker and moving on. Now, all this preceded the tsunami. Mm-hmm. So the UN is now dealing with probably the three greatest, most urgent problems in the world today: the tsunami, the forthcoming Iraq elections, which the UN is in charge of, and the crisis in Darfur, in addition to hundreds of other major issues ranging from HIV/AIDS to the Mideast. But on those three issues, Darfur, tsunami, Iraq elections, and the Iraq elections are the most important thing on the Bush administration agenda, the UN is at the center. So these attempts to call for Kofi Annan's resignation, as several congressmen and senators did, to destroy the UN by attacking it continually, which comes continually from certain journalists and commentators, these are very misplaced. The UN needs the U.S., and the U.S. needs the UN. It's as simple as that. Kofi Annan, who is, I have to stress, a very close friend of mine and a friend of all the people who assembled, just was reaching out for advice when he had that meeting, and it was one of a number of meetings. The article is essentially quite accurate, by the way.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned it was a horrible year, and he also says that, Mr. Annan also says that about the past year. The UN faced charges of corruption, including charges against his own son. Peacekeepers in Congo were discovered to be running prostitution rings. There were accusations that Annan hadn't reorganized his top team when he could have. It sounds in the reporting as if this was kind of an intervention. And I know you said it's a series of meetings, but how did he take your advice that it now is not the time to be adversarial?
Within a week, he was in Washington having farewell meeting with Secretary of State Powell, a very important meeting with the incoming Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. President Bush called him before Christmas to exchange greetings and pledges to work together in the coming 2 years. That was a very important call, which has not been reported previously, but Secretary General Annan mentioned it to me. And this preceded the tsunami. And very importantly, the Secretary General has already announced a major appointment. He has announced today the new chief of staff, which is probably the second most powerful job in the UN, second or third, is going to go to Mark Malik Brown, a British citizen who is currently the head of the United Nations Development Program.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Malik Brown is a superb, brilliant man. I've worked with him for many years, and I think this appointment is going to re-energize the UN. This was not an intervention. It was a group of friends of Kofi Annan talking about the need for a strategic vision for the next 2 years. And it was summed up by one of the people who said, this isn't the last 2 years of a 10-year term as Secretary General. It's the first 2 years of a two-year it's the next 2 years of a two-year term.
Richard Holbrooke, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, speaking to us about a meeting he and others had with Kofi Annan, head of the UN. Mr. Holbrooke, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Congress is back. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush formally welcomes the 109th Congress to Washington today. But while smiles and handshakes are expected at the White House welcome event, the mood could change considerably on Capitol Hill in the next few months. Contentious issues such as Social Security reform are making some Republicans nervous. And despite the record federal deficit, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said on the Today Show this morning that the U.S. can afford to meet its financial commitments and increase aid to tsunami-ravaged countries.
We can afford it. I can tell you we can afford it as an American people and really as a reflection of the oneness of humanity around the world.
Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Andrea Stone. She covers Congress for USA Today. And Andrea, what do you expect Congress will say about tsunami aid, given all the other federal spending that's in the works?
There's been such an outpouring of concern about the tsunami victims. And, of course, you know, early on when the government's, our government said they were going to give $15 million and then $35 million, and there were complaints that it was kind of stingy. And, of course, now it's 10 times that amount. I think that Congress will pass $350 million, and I wouldn't be surprised if they added a few bucks, because this is something that everybody can be in favor of.
It's a noble effort, but can the country afford it, especially with the war in Iraq and the federal deficit at record levels?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, you know, we've got a federal deficit, as you said, and it can just get a little bit bigger. The White House is going to be coming up with a new budget in February, and it's not even going to include, I think, another $80 billion that we're going to need for Iraq. And we're not even talking yet about Social Security, which if, you know, if it goes as planned, and that's a very big if, there will be enormous transition costs to introducing private accounts.
Well, let's talk about Social Security and other issues. The American Conservative Union says there's going to be two epic battles in Congress in 2005, a high court appointment and the privatization of Social Security. But even as you said, some prominent Republicans are resistant to the idea of privatizing Social Security. So what's your educated guess that this might happen this session?
There's going to be a lot of talk about it. They're going to certainly try. Republicans are certainly going to try to do something about it. But the Democrats, almost to a person, are opposed to this. They see it as sort of the camel's nose inside the tent, that once you take a certain percentage of Social Security taxes and put them into private accounts, then it's just a matter of time before the whole, you know, the whole pension system becomes private. So Democrats are really going to fight it. They had a real blow this weekend. They lost a Congressman, Bob Matsui of California, who was had a fascinating life. You know, he's a Japanese American who, as an infant, was interned in internment camps during World War II. He was going to be the key point person for the Democrats on Social Security, and he's gone now.
Yeah, and this was a big surprise. People didn't know he was suffering from a blood illness.
A rare blood, and it was a real shock.
Yeah, so there's that loss in many ways. But let's look at another issue that's being considered, the high court appointments. Mm-hmm. How contentious an issue is this supposed to be? Last month, the president made what the Washington Post is calling a bullheaded move to renominate his most controversial judicial picks for federal judgeships. Mm-hmm. So he's got several battles.
Right. There's two separate battles. There's the judges, the federal judges, and then there's the Supreme Court justices. Chief Justice William Rehnquist is being treated right now for thyroid cancer. It's not clear how serious the cancer is. And, you know, he's a pretty conservative guy, and so I don't think it'll be as crucial for the Democrats if the president nominates someone who has similar views. I think it's going to be more of a battle when some of the more moderate to liberal members retire, if they retire anytime soon.
Well, this Thursday, the Senate Judiciary Committee takes up President Bush's first cabinet nomination to come up in his second term, that of White House legal counsel Alberto Gonzalez for Attorney General. He's also said to be a future candidate for the Supreme Court. So is this Thursday's nomination process, you know, sort of a dress rehearsal for a possible Supreme Court nomination?
He's going to get grilled ruthlessly by the Democrats, especially, you know, he was the person who wrote some very controversial memos dealing with the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which had been interpreted by some as condoning what you know, the international community would consider torture. So he's going to be grilled on that topic. I don't think it's going to kill his nomination. I think he will in the end get confirmed. And after that, he will become a front runner for the court.
Well, House Speaker Dennis Hastert is also expected to handily win re-election to his leadership post this week.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a headline-grabbing politician, but apparently they say that behind the scenes he's tougher than he appears. Can he rein in what seem like more than usual contentious conservative Republicans?
Well, that's going to be the big trick. We're probably going to see more of Denny Hastert because before we saw the majority leader, Tom DeLay, out front, but he's had a lot of problems. He was reprimanded by the House Ethics Panel last year. There's a lot of ethics questions that are hanging over him, so he may take a lower profile in the next Congress, and we may see more of Hastert.
Well, you mentioned Tom DeLay's being admonished by the House Ethics Committee for his fundraising tactics.
Right.
As you said, the fact that he was questioned enraged a lot of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
It's thought the head of the Ethics Committee is going to lose his job over that. And today, some congressional watchdog groups are protesting other moves that are planned.
Right.
What's that?
Well, Hastert is talking about basically weakening the ethics to make it much harder to bring charges against a member, doing some of the things that the Republicans, when they came into the majority in the House 10 years ago, said they were going to end, that Democrats have been doing for 40 years in the majority. And it will be interesting to watch, I mean, whether that will backfire in the 2006 election.
Given that there is going to be midterm elections, can they really do away with the rule that got Tom DeLay in trouble that says that a member cannot bring discredit on the chamber? Won't there be some payback for that?
Oh, there's going to be big time. But, you know, the Democrats have to get the majority first.
So Dennis Hastert is threatening to change some rules. But to the other question, can he rein in these contentious conservatives in the party?
That's going to be a big question. You know, the last election increased the number of conservatives in both the House and the Senate. And these people are social conservatives, but more to the point, they're fiscal conservatives. You're going to see a lot of talk about spending. We're already seeing talk about cutting the Pentagon budget, something we haven't heard since the 9/11 attacks in 2001. So even the Pentagon and the Defense Department are going to have to, you know, curtail their spending. So we're going to see a lot of that.
Mm. Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today. Andrea, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And this look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now, from the iPod to that little movie called Sideways, the cultural landmarks of 2004, and what may lie ahead in 2005. Also a conversation with author Cynthia Ozick. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 2005 is underway, and millions of Americans, many grateful to be alive in 2005 after last week's news, launched this new year with resolutions to improve their lives. The most popular, losing weight, and streamlining personal finances. My financial reporter Mark Mills says he can't be much help on the dieting front, but he does have some ideas about managing money. Mark is also a CFP, or Certified Financial Planner. He joins us in the studio. Hello there.
Happy New Year, Robin.
Happy New Year to you. And one can hope, again, after the news. But I'm all ears. Get us started with your personal financial suggestions.
Well, you know, people do feel like it's a time to get a fresh start, and some of the areas that have been maybe a little discombobulated in their lives are a place to begin to focus, and mm-hmm. money is certainly one of them. And a lot of people do get a raise when the year starts. Admittedly, many of them have been meager in recent years, but still, even 2 or 3, 4% is something to work with. And you can think about using that extra cash to increase your savings, maybe for retirement plans or a college fund, or building up a cash cushion to have a little more safety in your life in the event that something goes wrong, or pay off debts more aggressively with that extra money. You've been living on what you were making at the end of 2004. If you're going to make a little bit more in 2005, you can still get by with what you had before,
right,
and do something with that extra money.
That's so hard, though, because the reaction is, oh, I have this extra money so I can go make that purchase, which is, of course, also what the government hoping. But you say the same thing. Don't spend it about this tax refund that might be coming in the next month or two to some people.
Well, you know, I don't recommend putting on the hair shirt and just saving all of it and being a miser about it. But if you're getting a $1,000 or $2,000 tax refund, have some fun with it. Make some plans to do something nice for yourself and your loved ones. But then also use some of that money to meet a financial goal. And again, to pay down debt if you've got any debts following the holiday period when people get those credit card bills in January and February, which are often steep ones. You want to make sure you don't let that get out of control.
Right, because you're going to start paying interest on it. Well, many workers have 401k or similar type savings plans at work. What should you do with those?
Well, again, you have the opportunity here to increase your contribution, perhaps, because of a possible raise. But you want to make sure you're contributing at least as much as the company will match. Many companies will match the contributions to a certain limit. If you don't max out on that, you're leaving money on the table. So that's step one. It's also a good time to review your investments. You know, a lot of times people make a 401k investment choice many, many years ago, and then they just sort of let it sit there and don't really look at it and manage it and pay attention to it. And it's a good time to at least review what you have been doing, which may be appropriate, but if not, you know, pay some attention to it. That 401k is going to be a big piece of your life down the road. You need to tend to it and take care of it. It's also a good time, Robin, to coordinate your retirement accounts. I know in my household, my wife and I each have several different accounts, IRAs and rollovers and 401ks. And
we should explain, because if there's previous jobs, you might carry it over.
Yeah. You know, we rolled over stuff from a previous job during a period where we were self-employed. We had a simplified employee pension. There are all these different accounts. Mm-hmm. And really, they all have the same purpose, which is to save for retirement. So you've got to coordinate them all and make sure that they're all working together and that they're invested properly. Don't look at them as individual little pots doing different things. It's all one big bucket going the same direction.
I want to get on to other things, but just like one example of how you might do that. What do you mean? You don't mean blend them. What do you mean?
Well, when I say that, I'd say, okay, I'm going to look at every single investment in each of these accounts and to see how it is invested. Is it in stocks? Is it in bonds? Is it in cash? Is it growth-oriented in stocks or a value orientation? Is there some international money there? I want to make sure I have all those numbers in front of me so I haven't created a hodgepodge that isn't being managed. I want to make sure I'm in control of it and I know how it's being invested.
And then it's varied in the way you want. And this goes to, you also say, that's your retirement accounts and 401ks, but you also say rebalance your investments. I don't know if you mean stocks in that case, but is that what you're talking about?
Well, rebalancing, and you can do this at any time, but in the beginning of the year, and again, when it's time when people are thinking about their finances, it's a good time to look at what your portfolio consists of. Rebalancing really is getting back to the intended way you wanted to have your money invested between stocks, bonds, and cash. Mm-hmm. They call that your asset allocation, to use a buzzword, but that's a very important decision. And how aggressively you invest, for example, if you have a lot in stocks and a little in bonds, that's pretty aggressive. If you have a lot in bonds and a little in stocks, obviously that's more conservative. Once you make that choice, and it's a critical choice to make, the marketplace will change your allocation because stocks and bonds will go up at different rates at different times. And after a period of time goes by, you no longer have the allocation you chose. It may increase your risk at that point because you now have a more aggressive portfolio than you intended. Or it may have reduced your risk because stocks did poorly, for example, and you don't have as much in stocks as you'd like now. So by rebalancing, you take charge of what your asset allocation is rather than just leaving it up to the whim of market returns to say, okay, here's where you stand now.
And what does that involve? Were you talking about buying and selling?
Yes, it would be. If let's say your target was 60% stocks, 40% bonds several years ago, and that's changed now because we had a good 2003 and a pretty good 2004. Maybe you're now 70% stocks and 30% bonds. You may want to sell some stocks and buy some more bonds to get back to the 60-40. You may say, I'm comfortable with the 70-30 that I now have, and that's okay. But at least look at it and take charge of it so that it's your decision about how your money's invested rather than just whatever's happening in the marketplace leaving you with, you know, what's on the table.
And I know you'd also recommend that for many of us, for me and others, that we do this with the help of a professional, because there's tax questions that are raised about some of these investments.
Yes, you're right. If you have money in a taxable account, meaning it's not in a retirement account, then there are tax consequences to selling some stocks and buying some other things, and you want to make sure you know what those consequences are. If it's in a tax-deferred retirement account, though, you can buy and sell in there without any immediate tax consequences, so it's easy to rebalance a 401k or an IRA, for example, because you don't have tax consequences on those trades.
Okay, and in the 2 minutes or so we have left, I know you feel that people should take a good long look, if they're lucky enough to be working, at benefits that they can get at work. What are some of those?
Well, the benefits at work, aside from the 401k, can be very valuable. For example, there are these flexible spending accounts that allow you to use tax-free dollars to pay for health care and for dependent care, which could be child care or elder care. And if you're not taking advantage of those, explore them, look into them. There also are similar tax-free plans to let people use pay for commuting expenses, your parking fees, your mass transit. Not as many employers have those as have the healthcare flexible spending accounts, but they're very easy for companies to open up and very inexpensive to operate. And there can be a big savings, in certainly in a city, if you're paying a lot for parking, you can get tax-free dollars to use the parking. And so you want to see if your employer could start something like that up if they don't have it.
And if you're already in one and haven't claimed it, you still have a little leeway.
Right. Even though 2004 is over, if you were in a flexible spending account and you have a balance there, you can still file until March 31st to get reimbursed for that money. But make sure you've located your receipts and get that stuff together and get it mailed in or faxed in, however it's done, to make sure you get that money.
Okay, Mark, just a couple seconds. I know you think people should bank online, that it's easy and it saves on stamps. And I know you think that we should get financial software. But I love this. Set up a tax file now. It would have helped someone like me.
You know, it's just get a manila envelope, everything that comes in the mail, and all the different tax forms that come in, stuff them in that file, and then when it gets time to get serious about your taxes, at least you've got all the stuff right there.
Despite the software, you need a little envelope.
All right.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Mark Mills, Here and Now's business commentator and a certified financial planner on what you should do in the year ahead. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. The bicentennial of the Lewis and Clark expedition has inspired museum exhibits and historical reenactments across the country. 200 years ago, Meriwether Lewis and Williams Clark set out to discover a water route to the Pacific Ocean, and in the process explored and mapped much of the Pacific Northwest. The team passed right through what is now the town of Iwako, Washington. Museum curators of the Heritage Museum there wanted to do something to mark the bicentennial of the discovery trek, but they knew they had to focus on something really different to compete with bigger, better finance displays elsewhere. Well, correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from the mouth of the Columbia River on the astonishing collection of kitsch that resulted.
It all started about 5 years ago when a family donated 8 gold-rimmed collectible plates to their small-town history museum. The plates depict scenes from the Lewis and Clark expedition, and they gave Iwako Museum collections manager Barbara Menard an idea for how to mark the upcoming bicentennial.
People are very enthusiastic because it's something besides Lewis and Clark slept here 30 miles down the road. Lewis and Clark slept here.
The museum put out a call for other collectibles, souvenirs, knickknacks, or anything else that latches onto the core of discovery.
And people started bringing things in from the attics, from the closets, from the boxes, things that they found on trips.
And some of the things actually are very nice and very serious and very real.
Exhibit builder Fred Matfield.
And some of them are utterly dreadful. And you never really know which is going to be which.
Matfield and Menard and a corps of volunteers have filled two halls with over 700 objects, none of them actual expedition artifacts.
We have such things as the Sacagawea gold coin mouse pad, the Sacagawea candy bar.
The what?
The Sacagawea candy bar, dark chocolate and raspberry. They do mention in the journals how they gathered the wild raspberries and were considered a treat and a delight. Here we have the Sacagawea perfume.
Oh, and what does it smell like?
Kind of outdoorsy.
However, the Lewis and Clark gin and vodka labels are a little different, with their their matching decanters, including Lewis and Clark, and there's one of York as well.
Lewis and Clark might have wished for some of the other items modern-day entrepreneurs have branded with the explorers' profiles, like the body lotion, scented Missouri Mist, or the lavender soap.
We have 6 versions of Lewis and Clark soap on display here. You'd think these were the cleanest guys in American history.
The museum shows how exploitation of the epic journey started shortly after the explorers returned to civilization and has never let up. In the 1960s, the buckskin-clad crew reappeared as a boy band, the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
They took the
They were a one-album wonder. Inspiration also touched the Great Falls Symphony and Symphonic Choir.
The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River.
want to leave the value judgment up to the eyes of the people visiting the exhibit. And so we'll let you come see, and you decide whether you consider it creative, interesting, unusual, questionable, poor taste. That's all up into the eyes of the visitor.
Historical purists may be pleased to learn the descent into kitsch is not complete. Yes, there are posters, money clips, snack foods, beer steins, and Christmas tree ornaments, but no one found a Lewis and Clark snow globe. The exhibit on the uses and abuses of Lewis and Clark in popular culture runs at the Ilwaco Heritage Museum through fall of 2006.
And our visit to the Heritage Museum in Ilwaco, Washington, comes courtesy of reporter Tom Bonsi. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Amish. Just hearing those two words, most people conjure up bucolic images of horse and buggies, polite children, a pure way of life. They don't think of incest. But in an article in the current issue of Legal Affairs magazine, Nadia Labi reports there is widespread sexual abuse and incest among the Amish, and law officials in the courts most of the time don't get involved. Nadia is senior editor of the magazine. She joins us on the phone from Colorado. Welcome, Nadia.
Thank you.
And you quote an Amish counselor in your article that the sexual abuse of children is almost a plague in some communities. Really? I mean, could you get a sense of how much it occurred?
Well, it's impossible to know for certain because there's underreporting, and I think that underreporting is particularly pronounced among the Amish. However, I became interested in whether or not it was an issue when I began looking into the story of a girl in Wisconsin who was raped repeatedly by her brothers and her cousins, and her mother knew about what was occurring. And as I began to investigate and began to look into the story a bit more, I began to find many cases of a similar nature. And the more people I spoke with, the more anecdotal evidence I seem to find that this was a particular problem in the Amish community.
Well, in fact, let's hear the story of the young woman that you were referring to, Mary Beiler, who was molested by brothers and others.
Yes, I became interested in her case because there was a trial in Wisconsin and her brothers were being prosecuted for raping her for many, many years, and both brothers had confessed to that rape. And both of the brothers said to me that where they grew up in Pennsylvania, that incest was not uncommon, and that they had sort of learned this behavior from their cousins who had also molested Mary. And everyone in that family I spoke with said similar kinds of things to me. I then went to the area where Mary Beiler grew up in Pennsylvania, spoke with a detective there who had begun investigating her case and had begun trying to find out whether or not sexual abuse was a problem in that community, and she was shocked by what she found. She was told many, many stories of abuse and had a lot of difficulty actually being able to prosecute a case, however, because in the Amish community, it is not accepted to really seek help from outsiders very easily.
Well, in fact, let's talk a little more about the Amish community and how what happens inside the Amish community might make these stories even more possible. You mentioned, for instance, that the brothers admitted that they did it. The men who are accused in many of these cases are often free to confess, and the Amish want to punish and forgive these men within their own community. They don't like to go through the law.
Exactly. And I think that's precisely what I became interested in as I looked into this story. Any community deals with problems like this of sexual abuse. And the question really is, how do you handle it when it comes up? And what I found in a number of cases in the Amish community was that there was knowledge of abuse going on, but the Amish system of punishment is one of confession and forgiveness. And what that means is that if a man or a brother confesses to rape or misbehavior of that kind, the community is actually required to forgive that sin, and not only to forgive the sin, but indeed not to talk about it after the punishment has occurred.
And it's tied into the system, the Amish notion of, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, gelassenheit, or submission. And as you explain it, children obey their parents, church members abide by the clergyman, sisters mind their brothers, wives defer to their husbands, everybody submits as Jesus did.
Well, there is very much a feeling in the Amish society of holding themselves separate from the outside world, and also holding themselves separate from the legal system, which uses force and prison as methods of punishment. Within the Amish community, there is an emphasis on submission and perhaps enduring particular kinds of suffering and being willing to readily forgive suffering.
And another thing that the system of forgiveness lends itself to is, as you write, anyone who even refers to a past sin after the Amish penalty has run out, let's say Mary's brothers were punished for, what, 2 weeks perhaps, and mm-hmm. someone could be punished up to 6 weeks, when that's over, if anyone even refers to it, then they can be punished in the same way because, again, they haven't forgiven as much as they should. That's amazing.
Exactly. And what that means, for example, is that Mary Byler is actually, by many Amish, considered to be sinning, not simply because she has left the Amish community, but because she has spoken quite openly about what occurred to her. And there is a feeling that she should have forgiven and then stopped talking about it.
Right. She was excommunicated. Well, you know, you can't help but think of parallels to the Catholic Church, which mm-hmm. has responded to charges of sexual abuse. The Mormons, who over the years were forced to split from the minority that practices polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a sense that this fiercely removed Amish community is going to at all respond to outside pressures over this issue of incest and sexual abuse?
I have a sense that they are, and the reason I say that is because, for example, there are two counties in Ohio that have large Amish populations that publish a booklet that's particularly targeted to the Amish that explains about sexual abuse and that is trying to educate the population about, you know, not doing it, and if it happens, reporting it. And also, I spoke with a social worker in Ohio who told me that she was trained and told that sexual abuse in the Amish community was pervasive, and she was taught particular techniques to try to work with the community.
And Nadia, one last thought. It's an important article, but you know, a lot of people travel to these regions to enjoy the scenery, to enjoy watching the people buying their crafts. Do you worry that they'll become demonized, you know, if information like this becomes widespread?
Well, certainly at this stage, I think the Amish benefit from the idea of the Amish as the gentle people, as gentle and non-confrontational. And there's a certain romanticism that's associated with the Amish, in part because of movies like Witness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have a long way to go before the Amish feel persecuted, and certainly I would not want that to be the case, but I think people should understand that the Amish are individuals like any other, and they have to cope with some of the same problems that we do. And if there are crimes, then they should also be punished in a similar manner to other Americans.
And their women and children protected.
Exactly.
Nadia Labi is senior editor at Legal Affairs Magazine. Her article is called The Gentle People. It's in the magazine's current issue. And by the way, for a link, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Nadia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer, Lindsay Crudell. Our interns are Jen Miller and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.